This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Once again, we'll call this meeting of House Judiciary to order and ask our secretary to please take the roll.
Representative Engel.
Here.
Representative Feinstein.
Here.
Representative Gibson.
Here.
Representative Gosch.
Here.
Representative Hamill.
Here.
Representative Hoffman.
Excused.
Representative Killer. Representative Lust. Representative Mosier.
Here.
Representative Schluckaway.
Here.
Representative Turbeville.
Here.
Representative Hunt.
Here.
Representative Cutler.
Here.
Madam Chair. Oh, Representative Killer. Thank you. Madam Chair, 12 of 13 are present.
Thank you, Madam Secretary, and we do have a quorum present. Well, good morning once again, committee members, and we welcome our internet listeners to this meeting of House Judiciary, and we hope that Representative Hoffman and his family are faring well out in Las Vegas, as their daughter is out competing there. And so don't know if anyone has a report back from him yet, but we wish him well. The chair seeks approval of the prior minutes.
So moved.
Moved by Turbeville.
Second.
Seconded by Hunt. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Are there any opposed? The minutes are approved. We have a brief calendar this morning, and we have one change in the calendar. The chair will defer House Bill 1066 to Monday, January 26th, as there is a need to do that. So that leaves us with three bills this morning, and we will begin this morning with House Bill 1086. Just a reminder to everyone who plans to testify to please sign in at the dais at the back door. And a reminder that we need to have all cell phones off or on vibrate. Thank you. So we are open to proponent testimony for House Bill 1086, which is an act to provide for and to require the attachment of an affidavit in certain garnishment proceedings. Proponent testimony for House Bill 1086. Good morning, Ms. Roberts.
Good morning. Good morning, committee. My name is Judith Roberts, and I'm legal counsel for UJS. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Chief Justice on House Bill 1086. House Bill 1086 was brought to the Judicial Conference on the request of judges. It is simply, I'd like to direct your attention to lines 8 and down at this time, because that is the meat and potatoes of this bill. It's just a method for the judges to do their job more effectively and efficiently. Unfortunately, many attorneys during the garnishment cases for the judgments, they do not give the needed information that the judges need. And having an affidavit attached to the motion outlining the different items from line 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13, 14 and 15, if an affidavit is attached, giving that information, it ensures that the judges will not have to go back into the file, do their own research, call, contact the attorney, get additional information, find out who the money goes to, where the money goes, how much, etc. So basically, our judges are having to slow down by doing the research that the attorneys can very easily and easily provide the court by attaching this affidavit to the motion. So with that, it's just going to help streamline the whole process. I need to address lines 6 and 7. During drafting, there was a little mistake as far as trying to make things in the code its policy to try and change it to make it gender neutral. And unfortunately, an error was made on line 6, the underline the plaintiff, the new language there, and I didn't catch it on time. That actually should be the defendant. And so, Madam Chairman, I'd like to make a motion that I would like to request that a motion be made to correct that. I'm sorry.
I'd like to make a motion.
Yeah, I would. I'd like to do pass on it. But no, that needs to be changed just for clarification, because we put the wrong party in that area and did not catch it until yesterday. And I apologize to the committee for that oversight. So I will stand by for any questions. As I said, we see it as a very simple thing, helping get the docket done in a timely manner, helping the judges, not having them do all the research. It's a very simple thing for the attorneys to attach this affidavit along with the motion with the information that the judge needs to complete the garnishment process. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1086? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1086? If not, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another question for Ms. Roberts. Ms. Roberts, could you explain for me, I reviewed this statute in isolation first, then I went back and looked at the entire chapter on garnishment, and I've done some garnishments. I'm curious, when does this motion come into play in the garnishment process? It says in line 5, plaintiff may in all cases move the court upon the answer of the garnishee. And so I was assuming that you've already have a judgment. You're seeking to execute on that judgment through the garnishment procedure. So what additional judgment are we asking for in this statute?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Roberts.
Representative Lust. Basically, this is the stage where the judge has to give an order to disperse any funds and the money and who it goes to and how much and the different, because there can, as you know, practicing garnishments, there can be more than one person standing in line for a garnishment. And so the judge has to figure out who gets what and how much. And sometimes it's difficult to figure it out. You do have the judgment, but then how do you disperse the funds and where do they go? And so we need that kind of information so that the judges don't have to go and call the attorneys or go researching and do the work. And this is just a straight, it's a very easy piece of paper. It's just the attorneys giving in an affidavit outlining who is supposed to get what and how, you know, how much.
Follow up,
Representative Lust.
And this goes beyond the changes you've suggested, but would a more appropriate word be order instead of judgment?
Well, Madam Chair, which line are you?
On line 6 and on line 7, and specifically in reference to what the plaintiff is moving for. The term judgment threw me off because you already have your judgment. I would think you would be seeking an order, as you've just explained it, from the judge identifying to whom the garnished funds would go. Does that make sense?
Representative Lust, it makes sense to me what you're saying. The judges didn't have a problem with that. They understand what's going on that part of the statute. They don't have a problem. That's the original language. They didn't see that as a problem. They understood the whole process and what's happening. What they're looking for is a little bit of help and clarification so that they don't have to do the attorney's job as far as all the research. And they just need to get this moving and completed. They needed that additional information without them having to go and calling and finding out where is this money supposed to go. So they weren't concerned with that original language. They just need the additional information that will be provided in the affidavit. So I can't speak for the judges. Apparently they didn't have a problem with that word.
Very good. Thank you.
Other questions of the committee? Representative Gosch.
My light on. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Roberts. Would it be fair to say that the purpose of this bill then is to streamline it a little bit, make the judges work a little more efficient so they can kind of get on with another case? I know we do have a shortage of judges, and so is this an attempt to make their job a little bit easier?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's exactly right. And it's not necessarily to make their job easier. The case is almost at this point completed. All they have to do is then to put the final touches on it, and to then have to stop and go back and go through the file and research and call, just like, as you said, slows down the process. This is simply a method for the judges to do their jobs efficient and effectively and get it completed and get the money to whoever it belongs to. It's already been decided. We just need to know how much and where it goes.
Other questions of the committee? Representative Ingalls.
Ms. Roberts. You wanted on line six, the plaintiff changed to the defendant. On line seven, where it says plaintiff, is that correct there?
Madam Chair, Representative Ingalls, yes.
Okay.
Other questions of the committee? If not, we will close to committee questions. Ms. Roberts, do you have an amendment prepared that the pages could circulate?
No, ma'am, I didn't. I had one, and there's still some problems with it. There's a little bit of confusion, so
okay.
I'm sorry I didn't
just
have.
Just want to make sure if you had it with you, we got it handed out. Thank you. We are closed to committee questions and open to committee discussion and or action on House Bill 1086. Representative Ingalls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move to amend the bill on line six, delete the underscored word plaintiff, and substitute defendant.
Moved by Ingalls, seconded by Gibson. Remarks on that motion, Representative Ingalls.
I think that's been covered. Thanks.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the Ingalls motion to amend? If not, that's a voice vote. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? That motion carries. We are back to House Bill 1086 as amended.
Madam Chairperson.
Representative Turbeville.
Thank you. I would move due pass on House Bill 1086 as amended.
Thank you. Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Gosch. Remarks on that motion, Representative Turbeville.
I have none, thank you.
Is there anything further of the committee? If not, we'll proceed to the due pass as amended motion on House Bill 1086. The Secretary will please call the roll, and those in favor say aye, those opposed no.
Representative Engel.
Aye.
Feinstein.
Aye.
Gibson.
Aye.
Gosch.
Aye.
Hamel.
Aye.
Hoffman. Killer.
Aye.
Lust.
Aye.
Mosher.
Aye.
Schleckaway.
Aye.
Turbeville.
Aye.
Hunt.
Aye.
Cutler.
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
And House Bill 1086 goes to the floor. Do pass as amended. Anything further of the committee? If not, Representative Lust, would you carry that on the floor? Thank you. We'll move next in the calendar to House Bill 1089. House Bill 1089 is an act to provide the court with discretion in ordering certain hearings on protection order petitions. We are open to proponent testimony for House Bill 1089. Good morning once again, Ms. Roberts.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Committee, my name is Judith Roberts. I'm legal counsel for the UJS here on behalf of the Chief Justice to testify in support of 1089. Currently, the law mandates judges to hold a hearing upon receipt of a petition for domestic abuse or stalking. This hearing must be held within a certain amount of time according to statute, regardless or not whether the petition or the facts contained within the petition rise to the level of domestic abuse or stalking. The UJS provides instructions on their websites of how to, and we also provide forms for anyone and everyone to go online, and you can also get them at the clerks of courts. These are free. You download them and print them off. They're petitions if you are needing one for domestic abuse or stalking, along with the forms that we have drafted and provided for the public so that they can do it without an attorney. We also have instructions walking them through step by step of how they need to fill this out, where they need to go, and what happens next. In the instructions, it says they must allege, and you walk through 1, 2, 3 for domestic abuse. For stalking, you must allege, and they go down 1, 2, 3, 4. One of these things, you must do it, and it's very clear here. It defines things like what is a crime of violence, and it defines other things for them. And then on our petitions here, we've tried to make it extremely simple for people, because it can be a very traumatic and intimidating time, and also the legal system can be a little bit confusing. So we've tried to make it as easy as possible for people. So we have check boxes of the things according to the statute that have to be, that are elements or part of domestic abuse or stalking. For instance, the person caused me physical harm or bodily injury, or they attempted to do so, or they've threatened to do so. They've been stalking, or they've been following me. They've threatened, harassing by means of verbal, electronic, digital, mechanical, and written communication. It's down there, and they can check those boxes. And then it goes on to after the boxes that you've checked, then it has a space. Describe what happened. And they don't have to fill up, you know, there's no requirement or length or a special form. You just have to say what happened. So that's what we provide for individuals who might need those. The judges would like to have some discretion on whether or not to have a hearing if the facts in these petitions do not rise at all to the requirements set by law for domestic abuse or stalking. For example, there are times where, and as I said before, it's mandated right now that if someone files this, regardless of what it says, you have to have a hearing. Sometimes someone will go in, they'll have a hearing. Everyone's there. They get to tell their story. The judge determines this does not rise to the level of domestic abuse or stalking for whatever reason. So he says, I'm not going to, or she says, I'm not going to do an order. The person, petitioner, can walk out, go around, come back in, fill out another petition, file it, and we are mandated to have another hearing within 30 days. That's one example of where the judge has already heard it. Nothing new is offered, nothing new on the petition, and they'd like some discretion saying, I just heard that last week, you know, and there's nothing new alleged. The other is if they simply don't fill out, they don't check any boxes and they don't fill out anything, or they don't check any boxes because none of the boxes apply, and they say something that has no bearing on and does not rise to domestic abuse or stalking. If a judge finds that there is not sufficient grounds whatsoever in a petition to grant a temporary protection order or stalking, then the judges should not be mandated to set hearings on a petition they already know doesn't rise to the level of domestic abuse or stalking. If it's the judge's opinions that the facts are insufficient to grant a petition, the petitioner would be advised accordingly, and then they can go and amend their petition and provide facts that he or she believes would meet the grounds for granting an ex parte order. And they would not be penalized for amending. There's no time frame. There's not a fee. There's nothing negative associated with having to amend and refile. We're not talking about a terribly complex form or process, only that the petitioner tell the story of what happened and that the facts of the story actually fit what is required by law. Also, if the petitioner is unable or is unsure about how to go about doing this, completing the petition or whatnot, There are numerous organizations across the state. There's shelters with paralegals. There are legal aid offices to assist. There's access to justice. There's different programs that would be able to just say, they can't tell them what to say, but they can kind of say, you need to give details or whatnot on this. So there are things out there to help. So that is the grounds for 1089. If you notice on line 5, that deals with protection order, and line 10 deals with a statute dealing with stalking, and the main line is if grounds are shown for relief. It still requires, it's still mandated that the court does order a hearing not later than 30 days. But by inserting that little section there, it will give the judges some discretion if they do see frequent filers or other instances once in a while that do not need a hearing on that. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you. Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1089? Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1089? If not, we'll close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Hamill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Ms. Roberts. Can you give me some sense of, you've identified apparently a problem. Can you quantify that? I mean, how big a deal is this?
Madam Chair, Representative, it doesn't happen. Our judges and, of course, the judicial branch as a whole take this subject very seriously. And I believe that we have attempted to do everything in order to aid the public in this area. As such, because of the forms and because we take them through step by step on how to do it, it doesn't happen often. It happens when someone is unfortunately abusing the system and using it to harass somebody. I used to practice family law. It gets pretty ugly at times. And there are people out there that unfortunately give other people a bad name because they use the system to harass somebody else and cause them problems. And they are familiar faces in the court system, as one example. And so in those instances, it bogs the docket because these are mandated that you have to fit them in the docket in the schedule somewhere where other people have to wait. But within 30 days, you have to have a hearing. And when you're having a hearing over and over, seeing the same people with no new facts alleged, but we're mandated by law to do it regardless, that is some of the problems. And it just creates a backlog. It creates frustration. And actually, it diminishes the seriousness of the whole issue for others.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I knew it was a time issue and bogging the system down. I just thought maybe you could give me a little bit more information on or to quantify it to some degree.
Madam Chair, Representative, are you talking about how many cases that we see this happening to?
On average, a judge that deals with this type of case, how often does the abuse happen? It is a time issue. I just was trying to get some sense of how big of a problem it was, that's all. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Ms. Roberts, would you just take a moment to explain what the purpose of the hearing that's mandated within that 30-day period, what the purpose of that hearing is.
Madam Chair, yes, committee. Basically, when someone comes in and files a petition, on one of the third page of the petition, they're asking to grant a protection order that either immediately, an ex parte, we call it ex parte, which means the other side doesn't have a chance to tell their side, and they can get a temporary petition order. So it goes into effect, and there is a protection order, and then you have to have a hearing on whether or not that protection order needs to continue. Same with if they do grant a petition order, they're only valid for a certain amount of time. And with ex parte petition orders, or ex parte, you have to give the other side a chance to tell their side to determine whether or not it should remain in effect and for how long, and the judge can determine how long, whether or not it's 6 months, a year, up to 5 years, I believe, is the limit. So it's a due process issue, and it's a determination to see whether or not a protection order should be permanent and for how long and what's going on.
Thank you. Representative Feinstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Roberts. Is there one particular area of the state or particular judges where this seems to be prevalent? Are we looking at just a very targeted area, or is it spread throughout? In other words, why really is this here? I mean, is there some underlying thing that we need to know to see if this is worth changing the current law?
Madam Chair, Representative, unfortunately, it's not limited to one area. People are the same across the state, and it is a frustration that is growing. And if I may explain why, one of the reasons is because we're helping people have access to the courts on their own, pro se is what we call it, without the need of an attorney, and we're streamlining and helping them by providing these for free. So we're seeing more people coming in who can do it very, very easily. There's no filing fee. We provide them with all the forms. We tell them how to do it, hoping that people who need to access this will, but unfortunately, when someone wants to be very vindictive, we're providing them with the means to do that as well. And so we're seeing more and more pro se, and that means we're seeing more and more problem people who can't necessarily afford to hire an attorney, and so they wouldn't maybe do it, but we're providing them with this. And so it's becoming more frequent, and the judges are expressing frustration because they do want to take this serious, and it's very frustrating for them when they see people wasting the time of the court.
Other questions of the committee? If not, we'll close. Representative Mosher, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Roberts. What is the means of notification to the petitioner when the judge rules that there is good cause to deny the hearing?
Madam Chair, Representative, if he denies an ex parte order, meaning I'm not going to do a restraining order, temporary, I'm not ordering a hearing, there is no notice to the other side because it's simply dismissed, and there's no legal ramifications to that party.
Follow up?
So if the judge denies the petition because he deems that there is good cause, I'm sorry, the continuance. If the judge denies the continuance, what's the means of notification to the petitioner?
Madam Chair, right. Representative, I'm sorry, I misunderstood you. You're talking about granting the continuance.
Yeah,
that's separate
I misspoke.
Than denying the petition. Okay, the continuance, there's notification that goes out to both sides.
Just a quick follow-up. How specifically are the grounds spelled out to the petitioner?
Madam Chair, Representative, may I ask for clarification? Are the grounds for what rises to the level of domestic abuse?
No, the grounds for denying the continuance. If the judge determines that there's good cause for not having the continuance.
Madam Chair, Representative, okay. When a judge would grant a continuance, we're not talking about denying the petition. We're talking about granting a continuance.
Yes.
Basically, that's a pretty simple process. That just means that the attorneys or parties have a scheduling date, a conflict or something like that, mm-hmm. and whether or not the judge feels it's legitimate or not.
Right.
For instance, if you'd asked to go to a U2 concert, the judge probably would say no, even though that's a great rock band. But if it's a legitimate, they would say yes. That would be a good cause. Going to a concert, would not, and they would say motion denied or continuance denied. And And that's basically how it's stated. But that's different from grounds on the petition.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there are no other committee questions, we will close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1089. And I guess I'd like to start a little bit of discussion about this. I know we've spent a long time just taking the time that we have today on an issue like protection orders, which is a little bit complex for people who aren't familiar with how they operate within the legal system. So I don't mind the time and the questions that we've had on it. I have a little bit of concern about not having petitioners going to a hearing that are denied the petition, because in my work over the years with this issue, I think there are certainly a lot of times when the abused person has difficulty stating on a form the nature of the abuse such that it rises to the proper level of legal discretion with the judge. And so what happens in those cases, even though the petition may be denied, there are certainly a number of petitioners who can then, because the court right now is mandated to set a hearing, go in and verbalize to the court what the problem that they're trying to seek some help about. And so having said that, I still support the bill because I think, you know, if petitions are denied because there truly aren't grounds, you shouldn't have to go ahead and have a hearing. I think the idea of the hearing is that when a petition is granted, you have the hearing so the defendant can access due process, as Ms. Roberts described, and then the judge can decide for what length of time a subsequent order should be in effect up to a five-year period. So I'm hoping that perhaps by the time we get over to the Senate, there may be some way to still include some of those petitioners who maybe aren't stating it very well on a written petition, that they are, as she indicated, oftentimes going out pro se by themselves trying to figure out what level of detail. You know, some people just don't put much detail because the page is this big and there are four lines, and that's all they think they can write. If there are just four lines, they write four lines. And so those petitioners subsequently are helped by having this type of hearing that comes up where they have an opportunity to verbally present and have some dialogue with the court. So that troubles me a bit, and I'm hoping that somehow there may be a remedy between the House and the Senate. I still urge passage of the bill, and I think we do need to allow the judges the discretion to eliminate those unnecessary hearings where there truly is no cause and nothing's going to happen at that subsequent hearing. Any other further discussion of the committee? Representative Ingalls.
I think this might bear just a little talk about the procedure from start to finish of how somebody gets a protection order and what steps they go through. Someone believes they're a victim of stalking or domestic abuse, and they want some protection from the court. They walk into the clerk of court's office. The clerk of courts hands them the form that Ms. Roberts showed us today. And oftentimes they'll stand right at the counter and fill out the form right as they're standing there. The clerk will be on the other side of the counter advising them how to fill it out. You know, you got to fill all this out. The clerk will look at the form and make sure that it's complete and that the boxes are checked and everything and that it's in the form to submit to the judge. The person will then wait at the clerk of court's office, and the clerk will run that directly to a judge. They'll find a judge right then and there, and they'll take it to the judge, and the judge will review it and make one of two determinations. They'll determine, first of all, if it rises to the level of an ex parte order, meaning they would grant protection immediately and it would be in place from that point forward until there's a hearing, and there'd have to be a hearing within 30 days. Or maybe it doesn't rise to the level of an ex parte order, but still we're going to schedule the hearing that has to be held in 30 days. So either they're going to get protection right now, or they're not going to get protection now, but a hearing is going to be scheduled within 30 days. Those are the two things the judge would decide at this point. Either way, the person will know right then and there because the clerk will bring it back to the person and say, this is what the judge decided. With this bill, the judge would also have the opportunity to say that, well, this petition, not only does it not rise to the level of an immediate ex parte protection order, but there's just no grounds on here that would get you a protection order at a hearing. There's just nothing there. From what I understand what Ms. Roberts said, the clerk would then come back to the person and convey to that person, the judge says that, you know, you just don't have enough in that form to succeed at a hearing if a hearing is held, so we're not going to schedule a hearing, but you're going to have the opportunity, you know, if you got some more, you know, if you got some more facts, put them on here, we'll take it right back to the judge and have the judge review it again. But otherwise, I think this is a good bill, because if the person doesn't have those extra facts to fill in, then I don't think that the court should hold a hearing, and I don't think that the sheriff should have to go and find the defendant and serve him with the papers, and the defendant should have to wait around for 30 days. This is kind of a summary judgment motion for the lawyers on the committee here, saying that if there's just no facts there, the sheriff, the court, everybody else is not going to have to deal with it. So I think it's a good bill.
Further discussion on House Bill 1089 and or action. Representative Ingalls.
Move do pass.
Second. Move do pass by Ingalls, seconded by Gibson. Any further remarks, Representative Ingalls? Thank you. Any other further discussion by the committee? If not, we will proceed to the vote on the do pass motion on House Bill 1089. The secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Engel?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamill?
Aye.
Hoffman? Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Mosier?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
And House Bill 1089 goes to the floor, do pass. And I will go ahead and be responsible for that bill on the floor. We have one bill left in our calendar today. That is House Bill 1035. House Bill 1035, an act to require the Secretary of State to redact certain numbers before furnishing copies of information. With that, we are open to proponent testimony for House Bill 1035, and we welcome you this morning, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Chris Nelson, Secretary of State. This bill comes from my office. As you know, the Secretary of State maintains a lot of different kinds of public records. One of those types of records are Uniform Commercial Code and Effective Financing Statement, lien statements. And those statements, by law, are required to contain Social Security or employer identification numbers for the debtors. And that's to be able to accurately identify who the debtor is. Those are public records. People can request copies of those public records. And obviously, in today's climate, we want to be very sensitive about providing Social Security or employer identification numbers to the public. And so what we're asking for here is that if a request comes in for one of those public documents that contains the debtor's Social Security or employer identification number, and frequently that's the case. If somebody is searching for a lien record, they will say, we're going to search for Chris Nelson, and here's his Social Security number. That's the common way of doing it. And if that request comes in, we would be able to provide them the copy of that lien to that person with the Social Security number included, since they've already got it. But if a request were to come in from somebody just says, I want to search for Chris Nelson, and does not provide my Social Security number, in those cases, we think it's appropriate to redact that number so that we're not providing it to the wide open public for anybody to do with as they please. And that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, really is the summary of this bill. One other thing I will point out, on page 3, lines 18 and 19, we've overstricken a sentence that talks about our UCC department having a toll-free number. That's been in the statutes for at least 20 years. It's never been implemented, never been funded, and as a cleanup, I'd recommend taking it out, although it's not directly related to the issue at hand. Be happy to answer questions when appropriate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there further proponent testimony for House Bill 1035? Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brett Kennecke. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I'm counsel to the South Dakota Bankers Association. We've reviewed House Bill 1035, as we would review all bills dealing with the Uniform Commercial Code, and have no problems with it. We would urge passage of it and thank the Secretary for bringing it.
Thank you. Further proponent testimony for House Bill 1035. Seeing none, is there any opponent testimony to House Bill 1035? Seeing none, we will close to proponent and opponent testimony and open to questions of the committee. Representative Gosch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the Secretary. I'm curious how the redaction occurs, because I've received redacted documents before that were blacked out with a marker after the copy was made, and I could actually see through the black marker and read what was behind it. But I know if you black it out and then copy it, it is truly usually redacted. So I guess how were you intending to do it? What is the process in the office now?
There's a couple different ways to do it. Obviously, what you have suggested is not a successful way of doing this. These documents, most of these UCC documents are optically imaged. Some of the very, very older ones are still on microfilm, but most of these are optically imaged. And we can actually go into our imaging system and do a temporary redaction on that system before we actually print the document. And in that case, there wouldn't be any issue. On those cases where we'd literally have to print it off a microfilm, then we'd print a paper copy, attempt to redact it, and if that didn't do the job, then we'd have to run that through the copy machine one more time.
Thank you. Other questions of the committee? Representative Lust.
Madam Chair, thank you. Secretary Nelson, this doesn't impact the fast file search currently, does it?
That is correct. It would not.
How do you follow
up, Representative Lust?
How do you how is the identity of the person requesting the copy confirmed?
Through the electronic system?
Either way.
If I might respond to that, we have an electronic system for filing liens and doing lien searches, and the subscribers to that system are lending institutions and attorneys. Do we know who the specific staff person is at that lending institution who's doing the request? The answer is no, we do not. They have login information specific to that institution, but do we know who the specific staff person is? The answer is no. If the request is coming in through the mail, obviously they've provided us a name and an address where we send that information back to.
My follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Lust.
I didn't ask that very artfully. It says in line 9 through 11 on page 1, certified copy contains the Social Security or employer identification number which has not been supplied by the person requesting the copy. Then it's redacted. My question is, how do you confirm that the person requesting the copy was not supplied by that person, by the individual whose name or Social Security number would be revealed?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I still follow the question, but if I could try to answer that, when that UCC-2 lien request, copy request comes in, it indicates who is requesting it, and typically, as I said, it'll have the debtor's name and Social Security number. And so that's how I would interpret this, is that number being supplied by the person who's making the UCC lien request.
Okay. That's it. That was the heart of my question. The UCC-2 is what you're
exactly.
That tips you off as to whether or not it was provided.
Exactly, yes.
Thank you. Other questions of the committee? Representative Feinstein.
Question for the Secretary. I know around the country, Social Security numbers tend to be real issues for ID theft and all that, but are there problems with employer identification numbers, and what affects that? I mean, I have not heard of any, and are you aware of any? And I'm wondering, therefore, why that is included. I mean, and then can you explain, please?
If I might, Madam Chair, no, I am not aware of any issues in that regard, but our UCC statute treats them the same. It requires that number, whether it's an individual or a business, and because it treats them the same, I put both of those in there, but I'm certainly not aware of any abuse there.
Any questions of the committee? Further questions? If not, thank you. We'll close to committee questions and open to committee discussion or action on House Bill 1035.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Turbeville.
Thank you. Madam Chairperson, I would move due pass on House Bill 1035.
Second. Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Lust. Remarks on that motion, Representative Turbeville.
No, this is a good bill, a good common sense bill, and I would urge the committee to join me in voting due pass.
Thank you. Any further discussion on the due pass motion on House Bill 1035? If not, the secretary will please call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, no.
Representative Ingalls?
Aye.
Feinstein?
Aye.
Gibson?
Aye.
Gosch?
Aye.
Hamill?
Aye.
Hoffman? Killer?
Aye.
Lust?
Aye.
Mosier?
Aye.
Schleckaway?
Aye.
Turbeville?
Aye.
Hunt?
Aye.
Cutler?
Aye.
Madam Chair, 12 ayes, 1 excused.
Thank you. And House Bill 1035 goes to the floor. Do pass. Representative Feinstein, would you carry that one on the floor, please? Thank you. With that, we have concluded our calendar. In case anyone had come and joined us late, we have deferred House Bill 1066 to Monday, January 26th. So we are through with our official business this morning, and the chair entertains a motion to adjourn. Moved by Turbeville, seconded by Gosch. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Are there any opposed? We are adjourned.